From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now, and we are getting new information today about President Trump's impeachment defense team. Ken Starr, the man whose investigation led to the impeachment of President Clinton, will join President Trump's legal team when the Senate starts hearing evidence early next week. Also involved, former Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz, who became something of a star over the years when he defended high-profile clients like Jeffrey Epstein and O.J. Simpson. Let's bring in Barbara McQuaid. She's a former U.S. attorney appointed by President Obama. She is not on the president's legal team. She is a professor at the University of Michigan Law School now. Professor McQuaid, welcome back.
Thanks, Peter. Glad to be here.
And what do these two pretty big names tell you about the president's impeachment strategy?
You know, both of these are very good lawyers. They've had long and accomplished careers. They both come with a certain amount of baggage, though, in light of scandals that they've each been involved with, their household names. And it really suggests that President Trump goes as much for image and tribe as he does for argument on the merits. I think if I were in his position and looking for the best lawyer out there, it probably wouldn't be a household name. It would probably be somebody who has successfully argued significant white-collar cases and constitutional matters in the courts in recent years. These two suggest to me more that he's as much interested in image as he is in legal acumen.
A statement from the office of Alan Dershowitz today said that he will be presenting oral arguments at the Senate trial to address the constitutional arguments against impeachment and removal. It went on to say that while Professor Dershowitz is nonpartisan when it comes to the Constitution, he opposed the impeachment of President Bill Clinton and voted for Hillary Clinton. So trying to make a point there that he's not being partisan in choosing to join this team. But wouldn't any lawyer have a hard time making that case, getting involved in something so political?
Yes, and I think when lawyers consider whether they want to get involved in something like this, they think about how it's going to affect their ability to practice law in the future. Now, both of them in their 80s and 70s are probably late enough in their career that they're not so worried about what comes next after a case like this. But it's important to set aside one's individual opinions and argue cases on the facts and on the law. But in a case like this, it's as much a political decision as it is a decision on the merits, and it's intended to be as impeachment. And so I think President Trump is, again, working to win in the court of a public opinion as much as he is in the court of the Senate.
I want to ask you about new evidence this week from Rudy Giuliani's associate Lev Parnas. Now, he was a key part of the campaign to pressure Ukraine to investigate the Bidens. He said that President Trump knew exactly what was going on and that he didn't do anything without the consent of Rudy Giuliani, who is the president's personal attorney, or the president. President Trump denies it. He said yesterday that he didn't know Parnas, and here he is in the Oval Office.
I don't know him at all. Don't know what he's about. Don't know where he comes from. Know nothing about him. I can only tell you this thing is a big hoax. It's a big hoax.
And we should say that Parnas was indicted in October on campaign finance charges. The president's supporters say he's not trustworthy for that reason. But do those allegations change the landscape of the upcoming impeachment trial at all?
I think so. You know, to me, one of the things that it suggests most is there's an awful lot of information out there that we still don't know about. And even if Lev Parnas himself is not someone to be called as a witness, there are plenty of people who are. Lev Parnas is the kind of guy who presents as a cooperator frequently for prosecutors. And, you know, you don't just take his word that President Trump was behind all of this and everyone was in the loop. You really try to pin him down and find out who else was present when these statements were made. What documents do you have that can support what you're saying? And then you use that evidence as the evidence in your case. But to me, it suggests that there's an awful lot we don't know. And I would want to hear from those firsthand witnesses like John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney and Mike Pompeo, the people who were in the room and had the conversations with President Trump.
At this point, what are the odds of that, in your opinion?
I think they're pretty low, but it just in light of what we've heard from Mitch McConnell, who leads the proceedings, you would need to have a majority of senators vote in favor of witnesses. That hasn't happened yet. But I think the way it could change is if information continues to trickle out, as it has over the past few weeks, at some point there may be enough public and political pressure on the Senate to recognize that they have to listen to this evidence before they can make a decision. And the risk to those senators, if they acquit quickly without hearing any evidence, is as this evidence continues to trickle out in the coming weeks and years, I think they're going to look like enablers if they acquitted without hearing that evidence.
Democrats are looking for 4 Republican senators. They're close, but yes, as you say, we will see. Now, I'm really interested in the nuts and bolts of how this Senate trial will play out. I mean, you know, if you weren't around for the Bill Clinton impeachment, you certainly weren't around for the Andrew Johnson impeachment in the 1800s. What is going to happen? How long will this take? And how much of the hearing, the trial, will the public hear?
Well, in the Bill Clinton case, some of it went off and was presented to a smaller committee. It wasn't presented before the full Senate so that they could be fact finders. In the Bill Clinton trial, they did actually hear from 3 live witnesses that was negotiated among the parties. And then a summary was presented to the full Senate.
Mm-hmm.
The Constitution is really silent on what a trial must look like. It just says that the Senate shall have the sole power to try cases of impeachment. And
yep.
So the senators themselves really can decide what that process looks like. They have some rules currently that permits them to call witnesses. And so we'll have to see what they agree to.
Barbara McQuaid, thanks so much.
Thanks, Peter.
It's been 2 weeks now since a U.S. drone strike killed Iran's top military commander when he was in Baghdad. And now we know American troops were injured when Iran retaliated with its own airstrikes on bases in Iraq where U.S. troops are stationed. That's contrary to what President Trump said, that there were no injuries in the Iranian attacks. NPR's Jane Arraf is in Baghdad. And Jane, what more do we know about the Americans who were hurt in these attacks?
Well, we were actually at that base, Tanya, just a few days ago, earlier this week. It's the Ain al-Assad air base in western Iraq. And we talked to soldiers and airmen and other service personnel who were actually there when the missile struck. And a couple of them said that some of them had to be evaluated for concussions because they were quite close to the blast, and these are huge missiles. They didn't put a number on it. They said there were several, and now it appears there are more, possibly 11. And it also appears that they've had to be medically evacuated, if you will, taken out of the base for treatment. Mm. At the time, they had told us that they were being treated on the base.
Do you have any idea why we were initially told that there were no injuries?
That's a really great question. I would hazard a guess that if we had been on that base earlier, or if we had been on the base, we would have gotten more accurate information. No injuries seem to have come from a statement from President Trump. A statement, as we know, his statements have not always been accurate or specific, and this seems to be the case. I would perhaps add that it seemed to me they hadn't quite realized the extent of possible concussions, which, of course, can lead to traumatic brain injury, because at the point where we were there, they said they were evaluating them.
The Pentagon said at the beginning of the crisis that it was going to hit pause on joint military operations with Iraqi troops against ISIS. Are those operations back on?
Kind of yes and no. U.S. official tells us that they actually did, U.S. forces did a joint raid and offensive operation against an ISIS suspect with Iraqi forces earlier this week, and that was the first they'd done since they suspended all operations with Iraqis due to security concerns for their own forces. It turns out that that raid was actually with Kurdish Iraqi forces, who are technically Iraqi, but it's a totally different ballgame in the Kurdistan region. The Kurdistan region is much friendlier to U.S. forces, so they wouldn't have the same concerns. So it seems it's not on again with forces from central Iraq, but there is still ongoing, there are still some ongoing missions with the Kurds.
Hmm. Another repercussion after the U.S. killed General Soleimani in Baghdad was the Iraqi parliament vote calling for the expulsion of American troops from Iraq. Where does that stand now?
Well, there's still that vote by parliament that asked for troops to leave. The prime minister still stands as saying he wants troops to leave, but in fact, he hasn't really done anything about it. They have to give a formal notification through the foreign ministry because this is all done through an exchange of diplomatic letters. And apparently that hasn't happened. So that's quite up in the air, actually.
Also, in Iran today, the supreme leader delivered his first Friday sermon in 8 years. What did he say?
Well, it wasn't as fiery as a lot of people would have expected, given all the tension that's been going on. But he did say, one of his main messages was, no compromise, no surrender. We will fight the United States. He actually called President Trump a clown. And the crowds cheered. They chanted that their blood ran in their veins for him. He also referred to the two people who were killed, along with at least six to eight other people, the Iranian general and the Iraqi paramilitary leader, as thought streams. And what that indicates is that he sees them as movements, that he's saying that because they're dead doesn't mean that Iran's attempt to send its fighters out in the region through Iranian proxies is over, and that that will continue.
That's NPR's Jane Arraf speaking with us from Baghdad. Jane, thank you for this update.
Thank you.
Democrats running for president met on the debate stage in Iowa this week, and one candidate who did not qualify for the event is still having a big influence on the race.
Mike Bloomberg for president. Jobs creator, leader, problem solver. It's going to take all three to build back a country.
Billionaire Michael Bloomberg is on track to spend up to $400 million on advertising before Super Tuesday in early March. Today, President Trump called Bloomberg's ad blitz a vanity project and said the ads were purposefully wrong. Either way, Bloomberg's spending has zoomed ahead of every other candidate in the race. Ken Goldstein studies political advertising at the University of San Francisco, and he joins me now. Ken, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So Bloomberg entered the race late in early November. He's already spent more than $215 million on advertising. Put that into context. Have we ever seen anything like it?
We have never seen either that level of advertising from one person in that short a time period and in the absence of advertising by people who he's running against. So Tom Steyer's also spent about $150 million. So you have these two billionaire Democratic candidates basically spending $4 out of every $5 that's been spent on the presidential race, dominating the race, but not spending it in the early states of New Hampshire and Iowa.
So what does that spending by the billionaires do for them that the other candidates can't do?
Well, it's interesting. There's all this nerdy theory, and I do a little nerdy theory as well, that says, you know, advertising is really not going to matter very much because of a couple reasons. You never have someone who's so dominant, and the effects tend to be fleeting, that you might get a little bit of a sugar high off the advertising, but then at some point you can't spend that much money for that long and have that big of an advantage for that long. Well, here we have a huge advantage, and it may just be the case that he's going to have that advantage for that long in Super Tuesday states.
Well, so the Wall Street Journal is reporting that his spending is actually changing the financial dynamics of the race. TV ad rates in a big city like Houston went up 45% when Bloomberg had a big million-dollar ad buy. So, I mean, in that sense, is he crowding out other candidates?
Yeah, that's interesting. And that speaks to something about his strategy that actually surprises me a little bit. He's in places like Houston. He's in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Dallas, Chicago. Listen, he's everywhere. I'm a bit surprised that he's not spending more nationally. So there's reasons to buy locally if you want to get the local news. But I think if you're buying in so many markets and so many expensive markets, it actually would have been cheaper to buy nationally.
And speaking of that, he's going to buy a very expensive Super Bowl ad along with Donald Trump.
Right. So both Donald Trump and Michael Bloomberg are spending $10 million on a Super Bowl ad. I think Bloomberg, I hear, is actually going to be spending a little bit more. So Fox is charging $10 million for the Super Bowl ad, but then to get the right to buy the Super Bowl ad, you then have to commit to another $5 or $6 million in spending on Fox.
Oh, my. All right. Let's listen to part of another recent Bloomberg ad. We're not going to hear from the candidate, but we do hear from people in several battleground states.
We need the Democrats in Michigan, too.
Here in Arizona, too.
And here, too, in Colorado.
And in Pennsylvania.
Wisconsin.
And Texas, too.
Rebuilding America starts today.
And all of us need to be heard.
Can you talk about the messaging of these ads? Because it does sort of sound like a general election ad and not a primary ad.
It is a general election ad by definition in those places, because those are mostly states that are going to be battleground in a 2020 fall general election. But I also, and listen, maybe it's also saying, hey, you need to listen to Michigan and not only pay attention to Iowa and New Hampshire, the early states.
Mm-hmm. Which he is avoiding. He's not even on the ballot in those early states, so he's going to these Super Tuesday states and beyond. Bloomberg is averaging about 5 or 6% in national polls. It's a lot higher than some candidates who have been campaigning for a lot longer. But it's also no guarantee that he's going to win by any stretch of the imagination. So, I mean, from his perspective, is it worth all that money?
Listen, it sounds like the obvious thing to say, but you know, that may just not be a meaningful amount of money to him when he's worth X billion dollars. He also probably thinks that his advertising will have some positive impact for the Democratic nominee, even if he doesn't get the nomination, which really is a long shot, because we're about to go into an environment now which is going to be consumed by impeachment, and what's not consumed by impeachment is going to be consumed by free media coverage, earned media coverage of Iowa and New Hampshire, and then the results of Iowa and New Hampshire. And it's really difficult to compete with what the coverage is going to be out and the bounce that whoever comes in first and second in Iowa and New Hampshire is going to get.
Tom Steyer's name came up. So let's hear a little bit from the other billionaire in the Democratic race. Here's some of his ad.
That's why I'm running for president, to end the corporate takeover of government and give more power to the American people. That's how we'll win health care, fair wages, and clean air and water as a right. I'm Tom Steyer, and I approve this message.
The non-billionaires in the race have made the argument that these guys are buying name recognition. I just wonder what your take is, whether or not this spending is good for democracy.
So they're clearly buying name recognition. And the candidates on the Democratic side certainly still have the ability to get their message out. What's interesting about this is there's lots of criticism of Iowa and New Hampshire coming early and such small, non-representative states having such a huge impact. But it would be possible for people to listen, I'm not sure you can buy an election, but certainly hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising would have much more of an impact if there was a single Democratic primary day. Hmm. Hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising would have much more impact if California or New York was the first primary. So the fact that Iowa and New Hampshire, where the candidates still have to go from living room to living room and talk to people, does blunt the effect of that money a little bit. And the free media coverage that whoever wins or comes in second in Iowa and New Hampshire is going to get will allow them to compete with a Michael Bloomberg. Look at our current president, how he won the nomination. He did not spend a lot on political advertising. He took every single opportunity to speak on radio, every single opportunity, of course, to speak on national cable TV. And it was that vaulted him into the Republican nomination.
That's Ken Goldstein, a professor of politics at the University of San Francisco. Thanks so much for your time. Very interesting.
Thanks for having me.
The third presidential impeachment trial in American history is underway.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons are commanded to keep silent on pain of imprisonment while the House of Representatives is exhibiting to the Senate of the United States articles of impeachment against Donald John Trump, President of the United States.
The trial opened with ceremony in the Senate yesterday. Lawmakers from the House, called managers, will make the case against the president. Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff recited the charges against him.
Article 1, abuse of power. The Constitution provides that the House of Representatives shall have the sole power of impeachment, and that the president shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors.
The second article charges President Trump with obstruction of Congress. He denies any wrongdoing, and his legal team will mount a defense in this trial. The Constitution mandates the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court will serve as presiding officer for the trial. And yesterday, John Roberts made the short trip across the street from the court to the Capitol. He was sworn in by Senator Chuck Grassley.
Will you place your left hand on the Bible and raise your right hand? Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and the laws, so help you God?
I do.
God bless you.
Thank you very much.
Senators were then sworn in by the Chief Justice.
Will all senators now stand or remain standing and raise their right hand? Do you solemnly swear that in all things appertaining to the trial of the impeachment of Donald John Trump, President of the United States, now pending, you will do impartial justice according to the Constitution and laws, so help you God? The clerk will call the names in groups of four, and senators will present themselves at the desk to sign the oath book.
Mr. Alexander, Ms. Baldwin, Mr. Barrasso, Mr. Bennett.
The first day of the trial yesterday ended with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell taking care of some procedural business.
I ask unanimous consent that the Senate sitting as a court of impeachment adjourn until Tuesday, January the 21st, 2020, at 1 p.m.
Is there objection? Without objection, so ordered. The Senate sitting as court of impeachment is adjourned until Tuesday, January 21st at 1 p.m.
It would take a two-thirds majority to remove the president from office. The only other presidents who have been impeached, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, were acquitted. Johnson by just one vote.
There is a new member of a very exclusive club on Wall Street. The stock of Alphabet, Google's parent company, reached a valuation of $1 trillion yesterday for the first time. It joins Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon in reaching those heights. Though I should say Amazon was in the trillion-dollar club only briefly last summer before dropping back down again. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, and he joins us now. Hey, Mike.
Hi, Peter.
So $1 trillion is a lot of money. What's driving Alphabet to that valuation?
Well, you know, just for first off, the sort of freshman finance explanation of what that valuation means, it's simply the price of their stock times the number of shares in the market, the number of shares outstanding. And so then the question is, what's driven this stock price so high? And it's really just this spectacular growth in Alphabet, you know, especially Google, the Google search engine and all the related products over the years. I mean, it's really just been eye-popping when you sort of take a step back and look at it. 10 years ago, revenue at Google was less than $16 billion. This year, 2019, it's not all in the books yet, but it's estimated to be about $133 billion.
Wow.
And that growth is just, you know, expected to keep going. The estimates on Wall Street for 2023 are for $220 billion in revenue. So it's just a success story when it comes to the internet search business.
The five biggest companies in the S&P 500 index are the four that we're talking about, plus Facebook, and they account for almost a fifth of that entire index. But Mike, if any of those companies are overvalued, and there are plenty of people who think they are, and if the stock market corrects, which it inevitably will, don't you think investors have something to be worried about here?
With that much concentration in that few stocks is certainly something to be worried about. You know, it depends kind of what is going on in the internals of the market. You know, we have seen periods in the last few years where these big important stocks have fallen by alarming amounts, but it was mainly because what they call rotation. Investors were sort of trimming their positions in these stocks a little bit and getting into some of the other undervalued parts of the market. So that has happened, and it really hasn't caused a lot of chaos in the overall stock market as far as, you know, the level of the Dow or the S&P 500. But you're absolutely right. If for some reason one or more of these companies should sort of lose confidence from investors, it can have a way oversized impact on the index levels themselves, which is most of us as sort of your 401k investors, that's what we're invested in, is that index, the entire thing. And that means we are all individually pretty exposed to these big companies as investments.
But if you want to buy a single share of Alphabet, you will have to pay $1,465. That's today's price. So I just want to make the point that a lot of ordinary people who cannot – there are plenty of us who cannot afford to participate in the wealth that this company is creating.
Yes and no. I mean, there are services that allow you to buy a fraction of a share in a company that has that high of a price. It is a more expensive way to invest, so it has that drawback. But again, when you think of the way the average Joe invests, it's most often in an index fund where you put a little bit of money each month in and you're buying basically the entire market as a pool in a mutual fund with other investors. So we are all, if you're invested in a 401k in a passive index fund, you are enjoying the benefits of these companies.
Bloomberg News, thanks so much.
The Environmental Protection Agency has racked up a backlog of unfunded toxic Superfund sites. The Associated Press reports that these 34 sites make up the biggest backlog of unfunded Superfund projects in at least 15 years. For more, we're joined by Judith Ink, a former EPA official. And Judith, remind us exactly what the Superfund program is.
The Superfund program is one of the most important programs run by the EPA, and it is designed to clean up or remediate the most toxic waste sites in the country. And if you know who caused the contamination, then the company or party that polluted the site is responsible to pay to clean it up. But then there's a second category of sites where you don't have a known party or the party's gone bankrupt, in which case you would use Superfund money to do the cleanup. But this is a very important program. It touches public health. It makes the difference on whether or not we have clean drinking water, whether people are directly exposed to toxic chemicals. And it really should be a top priority whether or not there's a Democrat or Republican in the White House.
Can you tell me how many sites we're talking about? What kind of projects are being funded under this Superfund program?
Well, there are thousands of Superfund sites dotting every state. Superfund sites run the gamut of old factories that went out of business, you know, closed the gate and then went away without cleaning up their toxic legacy. You've got big sites. You've got relatively small sites, but do tremendous damage, like old dry cleaners. What I'm particularly concerned about is this whole new generation of chemicals, PFAS, known as forever chemicals. They currently are not always, but sometimes are eligible for Superfund cleanups. But when all of those sites are identified and come onto the federal Superfund list, the bill is going to be even bigger.
Based on your experience, why do you think the backlog got so bad? Why is it so big?
Well, I think it got so bad because President Trump and his EPA simply don't care about environmental protection and public health protection. We need to remember
they're actually pushing back on that and saying that they removed a huge number of sites from the list as projects were completed. I mean, they're saying this is a significant step in the right direction. But even still, there's this huge backlog.
There's a backlog, but I think they're incorrect when they make that case. What the Trump administration is interested in doing is pushing Superfund sites off the list so that they can be redeveloped. And if a site is cleaned up, that's a good thing. But it takes decades to get these sites cleaned up. The current concern is that they're not funding sites that are ready to go, but there's not enough money. And I think it goes back to the broader problem with the Trump administration, regardless of what they say. They are not committed to environmental protection, and there's no sense of urgency to deal with these Superfund sites that communities are really struggling with.
Judith, I want to bring in Ed Lorenz. He lives in the neighboring town of one of those unfunded Superfund sites in St. Louis, Michigan, and he's chair of the Pine River Superfund Citizen Task Force. Ed, can you briefly give us the backstory of this site and the company that created it?
Okay, yeah. This is a site that developed from the operation of what was called Velsicol Chemical. Velsicol dumped all sorts of chemicals in the environment here from the manufacturer of pesticides, fire retardants, and other products. And they made a catastrophic shipping error in 1973, shipping a fire retardant instead of an animal feed supplement that they also made. The fire retardant was mixed with animal feed. It ended up contaminating the food chain for at least 8 million people, probably more than that. And for over a year, it wasn't known that this had happened. So they were responsible for this massive food contamination, which ended up putting a fire retardant in the bodies of huge numbers of people across Michigan, the upper Midwest, and to some extent nationally.
You mentioned all of the contaminants that this company produced, including DDT, a synthetic pesticide that Rachel Carson wrote about in Silent Spring. Give us a sense, does this still pose risks to wildlife or people in St. Louis today?
One of the surprising features of our site was we continued to have, for example, robins dying in the yards of houses in town down through the early 2000s. And finally, through years of complaining, we had them investigated and found out they were still consuming DDT that the company, through its careless operations, had allowed to be spread across the neighborhoods near the plant. And eventually, EPA had to come in and they removed something like 50,000 tons of soil around over 100 houses that were in the area near where this plant is. The plant is long gone. It hasn't operated since 1978. But we were doing residential soil cleanup in 2012.
Yeah, I can only imagine that's the other part of this battle. Really looking at people who have these health issues that have been caused by this company. And that's not funded by the federal government. And you say that's a shortcoming of this Superfund program, is that it's not really addressing the health needs of the folks who are impacted.
Right. I think one of the big problems with, Superfund, there are all these health consequences. We are finding them. We have a long-term health study going on related to the people exposed to the fire retardant. And people are still coming forward who have fundamental health problems that seem to be tied to this. And none of the cost of that is in the Superfund budget. It falls on the responsibility of whether it's local health departments, or in some ways, private medical care providers, physicians, clinics, this sort of thing. The Superfund budget should be massively larger to pay for these health treatments, responses to these health problems.
Judith, let's go back to you for a minute. What we are hearing from Ed is significant. What do you see as some of the main risks for not funding these sites?
Well, I'm very moved by what Ed said, and he's absolutely right that Superfund deals with sites. It doesn't deal with people whose health is compromised because of exposure to chemicals. So, you know, he mentioned DDT, something we haven't heard about in a long time. I dealt with, and EPA is still dealing with, a site in Newark, New Jersey that made Agent Orange. We've got PCB sites being cleaned up, like the Hudson River, even though PCBs were banned decades ago. So I think the fact that EPA is telling us that they don't have enough money to start cleanup on sites that are ready to go is really troubling. And the reason why Superfund has been super slow is there's never been enough money to cover all of these sites, whether they're funded by polluters, which is the case in 60% of the sites, or funded by federal and state taxpayers.
What advice would you give Ed Lorenz and his task force and all of the folks throughout the country who have been working in this space, pushing for cleanup and more money to help in health services. What do you tell them?
Well, I don't have a particularly reassuring message other than what they're probably doing, which is to stay very, very close in touch with their elected members of Congress. The one thing I learned during my tenure at the EPA during the Obama administration is when members of Congress call, the agency pays more attention. So I think that's important, along with keeping the issue visible in the local media, involving lots of new people in your organization. And it's actually kind of heartbreaking that this becomes almost a full-time job for many volunteers around the country trying to hold the EPA and polluters accountable for the cleanup. The system should just do it on its own, but it doesn't.
That's Judith Ink, former EPA official, and Ed Lorenz, vice president of the Pine River Superfund Citizen Task Force in Michigan. Thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
There is a sign today that the labor market might be slowing down after a long stretch of job growth. The Labor Department reported this morning that the number of available jobs last November dropped off sharply, and that appears to agree with the recent December jobs report. Some economists think employers aren't hiring as much because they're not sure about the economy in 2020. And our next story is about one presidential candidate's answer to economic uncertainty and a changing job market. It is the Freedom Dividend, and it's the centerpiece of Andrew Yang's campaign, a payment of $1,000 every month to every adult in America, no strings attached. To show what it could do for people, Yang chose a family in New Hampshire to receive the dividend in 2019. And now that the year is over, New Hampshire Public Radio's Todd Bookman visited the family to find out just what they did with that money.
The Fassie family are Chuck and Jody and a college-age daughter named Janelle. They have a dog, a savings account, and a dining room table that rarely gets used. There's a history of mental illness on Chuck's side, and he struggled at times. Jody remembers what happened a few years ago when Chuck lost a decent-paying job with a chemical company.
And then he had like a breakdown because he couldn't really understand what happened to him and what we were going to do now for money. He couldn't handle it, so he went into the hospital for a week.
You know, you got a daughter in college, you don't have an income, you know, you have bills coming in, you know, no livelihood to pay them, and it does a lot to your psyche. You know, it makes you feel like, you know, you're less of a, you know, you're not even a human being.
They sold Chuck's Camaro. They cut back on spending. Then in the fall of 2018, just as Chuck landed a new job, their daughter Janelle saw Andrew Yang give a speech. He was looking for a family who could serve as a test case for universal basic income.
I didn't really know who Andrew Yang was when Janelle kind of came to us saying, hey, there's this Asian guy running for president and he wants to give everybody $1,000 a month and he wants to start with you. I'm like, okay.
Universal Basic Income, or UBI, comes with no strings attached. The concept has had a range of backers over the years, from Thomas Paine in the 18th century to free market economist Milton Friedman. Under Yang's plan, everyone over 18 would qualify. To implement the policy on a nationwide scale would cost close to $3 trillion a year. Yang is proposing paying for that with a value-added tax, which is common in Europe. Putting aside whether this is smart policy or even feasible, and plenty of people don't think it is, Yang handed Jody the first check for $1,000 on New Year's Eve of 2019.
So we just kept putting it in the bank, and then when Janelle, of course, when her tuition payment came, it was very, very relaxing knowing I had that money in the bank.
The year of free money ended in December. Of the 12 grand, the Fassies put about 10,000 of it toward college. That's money Janelle now won't have to borrow in loans. The Fassies don't have receipts for how they spent the other 2,000 bucks, but they recognize ways, small ways, that the UBI changed them.
Even going to the grocery store, you know, we weren't, without thinking, we were like, oh, we want that, we, you know.
So, give me some examples. What were you buying at the grocery store that you wouldn't normally have bought?
Well, our daughter is very organic, so she buys expensive peanut butter, kale.
Yeah, I had the special yogurt that's like $1 a piece.
$1.50 a piece.
$1.50.
That was Janelle there with the fancy yogurt. Chuck also experimented at the grocery store, picking up the fermented and pricey tea called kombucha.
So Chucky would sneak that into the grocery cart anytime that we were at the grocery store. And I kept saying, okay, you know, when this money stops, this is going to stop. Because $8, $9 for one bottle, we can't afford that.
The freedom dividend, as Yang likes to call his UBI plan, also prompted Chuck to try something he heard could be good for people like him with anxiety.
When we first started receiving it, I actually started taking improv classes for my mental health. And that was $100 a month. And I know that, you know, getting the freedom dividend, we noticed that we were doing things that we normally, if we weren't receiving it, we weren't going to do.
With an extra $12,000, the Fassi family chose college tuition, healthy food, and improv classes. It's easy to imagine other middle-class families doing the same, a mix of the financially prudent with some extra set aside for the things that make life worth living. It's exactly what Andrew Yang has in mind. I asked him about it after a recent rally in Concord.
I think Chuck even worked on some kombucha and some home crafts. So there are many things that happen that were very positive with the Freedom Dividend. And this is the trickle-up economy. And the Fassi family demonstrates just how positive it can be.
Yang is the only Democratic candidate backing a UBI plan. As for the Fassies, with the freedom dividend gone, they're learning how to dial it back. Less kale, a daunting college tuition bill coming. Still, it was a good year for the family. They say they're all planning on voting for Yang in the primary. And since his freedom dividend was given with no strings attached, Yang's campaign says that's not vote buying. For Here and Now, I'm Todd Bookman.
Tanya, I was reading into that story and I was just dying to know what they were going to buy with that dividend.
I know, $1.50 yogurt.
Organic
kale,
vegetables and acting classes. Good for them.
That's right.
That's fascinating. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young. There's a movement to bring more secular spirituality, not religion, into schools. We'll take you to Columbia University's Spirituality and Education Conference.
How can we get children and adolescents to be mindful, sensitive, conscious?
And we'll set the stage for the impeachment trial next time, Here and Now.